This is Ahval Online, meeting point of accurate news and free comment on the current affairs of Turkey. Welcome to our podcast series.
Okay, good morning or good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. This is another episode of Anatolian Dispatch, part of the Ahval podcast group. Ahval News is your best source of information for everything that's going on in Turkey. Anatolian Dispatch focuses primarily on the relationship between Turkey and the United States. Today, our guest is Blaise Mishtal, who works with the Jewish Institute for National Security of America. He also has worked in the past in national security affairs for a number of different Washington groups. And brings a great deal of knowledge. Most recently, he wrote a long piece, which I would strongly recommend that you read. It's a U.S. strategy for a lonely Turkey. And it looks in depth at what is the way to move forward with the relationship between the United States and Turkey. And we'll get to that after an earlier question, which I want to pose to him. Some of you may be aware that 103 admirals, and now it seems some additional people have signed on to a letter, an open letter that they wrote, criticizing the government of Turkey's Islamization of the military and of the government in general. And if, Blaise, I could get your comments on that, and then we'll segue from that into this, I think, very good piece that you guys wrote, that you wrote on the strategy for the United States engagement with Turkey. Go ahead.
Sure. Well, first of all, thanks for having me on. It's always a pleasure and always I'm delighted to turn and learn more about Turkey from Ahval News, which I think is one of the finest sources we have to learn about what's going on in the country. I think when it comes to the letter that you mentioned, we have to separate out at least three issues. The first is the content of the letter, the actual criticism that was made by the signatories of the letter. The second is sort of who the signatories were and whether they should have been making this criticism. And then the third is the government's reaction to it. So on the first piece, in terms of the content of the letter, it sort of had this two-pronged attack on the government's recent policies. One was a horrible reaction. How possibly could they, to suggestions that were made by members of the AKP and members of the parliament about the possibility of withdrawing Turkey from the Montreux Convention, which governs passage of naval ships through the Bosporus and through the Dardanelles, with the suggestion having been made by the government that with building Kanal Istanbul, maybe that wouldn't be subject to the convention and maybe President Erdogan could unilaterally withdraw Turkey from that convention. So I think that, the merits of that and then the merits of the second critique, which was about the Islamization of the military, as you mentioned, after pictures were published of a general going to see an Islamic sect wearing robes and a headdress. I think on the merits, those are really important debates to be being had in the Turkish public sphere. Both as a matter, especially on the first point of the Montreux Convention, both as a matter of strategy, what is the value of the Montreux Convention? And I think there's a very strong case made by the signatories of the letter that it's been an important part of the stability of the region and of Turkey's importance to the region. And also, more importantly, perhaps, the legal question of does President Erdogan have this ability to unilaterally withdraw Turkey from the convention, especially after we saw him do that with the Istanbul Convention, having to do with the rights of women. And I think this is yet another example where we've seen President Erdogan sort of ruling by fiat and trampling on the rule of law. I think it's definitely important for those issues to be being raised. Question is, are 103 admirals, retired admirals, the right people to be raising these issues? And here I think, as horrible as the AKP government's reaction was, arresting 10 of these of the leaders of this group, and criticizing them and calling this a coup plot. I do think there's something to be said for the fact and for the value of civilian control and civilian rule, which we also have in the United States. And I'd say, if anything, you know, as an observer of U.S. domestic politics, the politicization of retired generals and admirals in the United States, where we see them, you know, taking stands, you know, backing one candidate or another, or being trotted out as proxies in political election fights. And also now, you know, sort of as we've seen with two administrations in a row becoming defense secretaries who are supposed to be civilians, not members of the armed forces, you know, making sure that the military is not taking a political stance, that it is apolitical, and that it is controlled and ruled by civilian elected officials is important. And so, especially given those, I think, general principles for any democracy, and particularly given Turkey's history with coups as recently as the coup attempt in 2016, whether it was strategically wise for these admirals to sign on to this letter is a separate question. But I don't think there was anything in the letter that suggested a coup plot or warranted the then harsh crackdown that we saw by the government, which I think sort of leads to the main question is about this incident, which has less to do about anything that was in the letter and really more to do about the relationships of the government with the military, with the security sector overall. And I think, you know, there's a couple interesting things going on here. One is that one of the admirals that was arrested was Cem Gurdinas, the author of the Blue Homeland Doctrine, which was largely seen to be sort of the guiding light of Turkish foreign policy in recent years. And it's also been the case that we've seen following the 2016 coup attempt and the massive purge of officers and other members of the Turkish armed forces. I think by some account, something like at least 5% of the armed forces were purged, a much higher percentage of officers. And the remaking of those cadres by Erdogan and more to the point, I think, by his governing partners in the National Movement Party, the MHP, you know, we thought we saw at least a rather tight reconnection between the government and the security services. And so there's a question, I think, of what does this bode, both in terms of that relationship, the future direction of Turkish foreign policy. Is this a move away from sort of the Blue Homeland Doctrine? And I think more interestingly, what does it mean for Erdogan's base of support? I think one of the interesting things that we saw, especially in 2020 and the sort of the adoption of Blue Homeland, is that Erdogan finally figured out a foreign policy that had a little bit of everything for everybody, right? I mean, I think, you know, his various attempts at past policies, whether it was zero problems with neighbors under Davutoğlu, whether it was you know, sort of whatever we call the period that came after that, which was, you know, sort of in the wake of the Arab Spring, the sort of the mad rush to support Muslim Brotherhood movements across the region, the deep engagement in the Syrian conflict. I think none of those resonated particularly far outside of the AKP political base. But now when you combine, you know, support for a Muslim Brotherhood movement in Libya that sort of checks the Islamist box with, you know, aggressive stance in the Eastern Med against Cyprus and the Greeks that checks sort of the old school secular nationalist box with support for Azerbaijan and entry into the Nagorno-Karabakh box, which conflict which checks sort of the MHP ethnic nationalist box. You know, he had really put together a foreign policy that was geographically expansive, but expansive on the Turkish political spectrum as well, and really offered something to everybody except for the HDP and the Kurds. And so I think really the question is, does this crackdown now, do these arrests, do they augur a crackdown? Do they augur a crack in that foreign policy and the political base that he was trying to build? And is it because he's now moving away from sort of blue homeland and the aggressiveness of the last year and towards, let's say a more conciliatory policy, seeking to engage other partners? And, we've seen this charm offensive since the start of this year. And I think it's remarkable and perhaps not coincidental that these arrests came, just a day before we had a visit by the leaders of the EU to Istanbul to talk about possibly patching up relations.
Yeah. On that, there was a lot of concern that the visitors from the EU were going to kind of gloss over the human rights problems that there are in Turkey, which have been worse since the coup attempt of July 2016, but have been ongoing and developing ever since the AKP really got fully in control. Maybe we're not going back to 2002, but somewhere around, say, 2008 to 2012, somewhere in there, the AKP, I think, started to feel so confident in its control, and Erdogan himself, that they started to have a more negative response to human rights concerns. But I don't think that either the United States or the EU has ever really pressed that firmly with you. So if we can take that, maybe to start peeling the strategy that you put forward. And if I could just mention a couple of the things about this. One of them is you talk about assembling a coalition. Now, obviously, the obvious partners for the United States in a coalition of dealing with Turkey are going to be NATO and the EU, which, of course, have a lot of overlap in membership, but maybe not with concerns and issues. You mentioned the misalignment, I believe is the term you used. Could you go into that a little bit about how that's going to affect this assembling of a coalition of like-minded states to deal with Turkey?
Sure. Maybe if I could just make one point before that on the human rights issue, since you raised it. I think it's important as we look back on that history of abuse of human rights and democracy and rule of law that has spanned the entirety of Erdogan's tenure, but has obviously sort of proceeded sort of at increasing pace. There's two things to note about that. The first is the way in which Erdogan actually was able to use the EU and the EU Court of Human Rights as a tool to consolidate his power and set up further his further ability to trample on Turkish democracy. So he started off with sort of this liberalizing rhetoric, pushing back against the military, and that's sort of what enabled him to then go on and do what he did later. And then the second related point is it's actually always been judicial excesses against the military that has set up and preceded sort of increasing waves of Erdogan's oppression. So we saw that with the Ergenekon and Bylos cases, which sort of set up that period that led us into the 2013-2014 breakdown with the Gulenists and the Gezi protests. Same thing with obviously the coup attempt and the purge of the military, but that also was used as a justification for a purge of broadly large parts of Turkish society. And so I think it's an interesting question whether, these are obviously just 10 arrests for now, but whether this is hearkening to a new wave of further repression, as we've maybe already been seeing with the campaign against the HDP parliamentarians, mayors, and others. So it is very important to pay attention to the human rights situation and to see these arrests potentially in that light. But on the topic of the strategy and the coalition, I think that there is an attempt by Turkey to reach out to various actors that we've seen, the EU we were just talking about, but also the Israelis, the Saudis, the US, the Egyptians. And I think the question is, why has there been this sort of this reversal suddenly, right? From 2020 being this very aggressive year in which Turkey entered into or was involved in so many conflicts so far from its borders, to now this charm offensive. Sort of the question that the report poses is this precious loneliness, as Ibrahim Kalin referred to Turkey's situation on the world stage, even way back in 2013,
right.
is it becoming onerous for Turkey? And I think in some ways it is, and the report sort of says this isn't really a foreign policy issue for Turkey so much as it's a domestic policy issue. There's obviously sort of great strains on the Turkish economy, which could prove politically problematic for President Erdogan. So he has reasons to want to find ways to bring foreign investment into Turkey to shore up the standing of the economy. And there could also be fractures within the ruling coalition, right. as perhaps these arrests we're seeing suggests. And attempts to sort of renew his standing on the world stage might be an attempt to shore up his standing domestically.
Right.
Which is why the argument that the report makes, it's important not to let him sort of play different actors off one against another, right? With the idea being, you know, if he's reaching out to so many different actors, it's probably not because he wants to improve relations with all of them, everyone, you know, from Washington to Riyadh, but because he needs at least one or two to sort of fall in his favor and give him enough breathing room to survive for however long he needs. And yet, because there are so many shared interests and concerns about Turkish behavior, right, whether it is the human rights, whether it is its involvement in Libya, in Syria, in the Eastern Med, in Nagorno-Karabakh, in Iraq, its procurement of the S-400s and turn towards Russia. I think all of these are interests that especially are shared in the transatlantic relationship, right? So between the U.S., NATO, and the EU, but also to a certain extent shared by, for example, Israel as another Eastern Mediterranean country. Shared potentially by the Egyptians as well. But the problem is that different countries prioritize these in different ways. So whereas the U.S. Has put a lot of emphasis on the S-400 issue, even though that should be an issue for all NATO countries, European countries have different concerns. The Greeks and Cypriots are more concerned about the Eastern Mediterranean issues. Germans are more concerned about migration issues. You have perhaps the Spanish and the Italians who have greater financial exposure from their banks to Turkey and are more concerned about limiting spillover there. And then you have the French who seem to be very invested in the Eastern Med issue as well. And so what we suggest is really Washington should play a leading role here in trying to bring some alignment between all of these actors, because our ability to get anything done on any of these issues that we all care about is undermined if any one of us makes a deal with Erdogan, right? So if the Europeans are now sort of trying to have a positive agenda with Erdogan and are investing and providing economic assistance and updating the customs trade union with Turkey, that decreases the pressure on Erdogan to, for example, deal with the S-400 issue or to do anything on human rights at home. And so the argument is sort of we're stronger together. And if we can come up with a shared agenda and sort of present a common front to Erdogan and say, you improve relations with all of us by doing 1, 2, 3, or you sort of have bad relations with all of us with consequences, 1, 2, 3. More likely to have a positive result.
Well, yeah, I mean, I fully agree with that. I think one of the things, I mean, from my time in Turkey at the American Embassy, and then since then, I think that Erdogan has been incredibly adept at playing off factions who are opposed to him or maybe have concerns. I mean, if they're internal, he's really been able to play off the different factions against each other. You know, you do a very good history of the involvement of the AKP with the Gulenist and how that kind of went sour in 2013. And then in 2015, after 2 years of really kind of an outreach to the Kurdish population and to the HDP, that got reversed. And the driver of all this has been Erdogan and his desire to remain in power, which clearly he wants to continue. And so you raise a very good question. Is or are the Americans, the EU and NATO, are we going to be able to come and have that sort of solidarity of we're all in this together, Mr. Erdogan, and you are going to have to make real substantive improvements in all of these areas, in the Eastern Mediterranean, in the hydrocarbons issue with Cyprus and Greece, in the Aegean, in Libya. Of course, you know, as you pointed out, there's a problem. Italy and Turkey are on the same page in Libya, while the France and Turkey are not, which means that essentially France and Italy are not on the same page regarding Libya. And so that has to be put right. And I think you're absolutely right that it's going to take leadership from the United States. I wanted to pick up on something that's in the report, which I really liked because, well, I've been saying the same thing. I think it's great that the White House has not reached out to call President Erdogan, because I think it sent a message to him that the relative importance of Turkey to the United States is not nearly as great as President Erdogan thinks. And I think another point that you make in the report, which I also agree with wholeheartedly, is that for too long, the United States has often approached Turkey as much more valuable to us than it actually is, as if it's the irreplaceable ally in that region. I wrote a piece a number of years ago when I was still with the department, which did create some bits of concern, where it had been cleared, but some people were not happy that it got out there, in which I said, you know, we do not need the resources and assets and facilities that we have in Turkey. It would be more difficult to forego those assets, facilities, and resources that Turkey provides to us. But there's the difference between what is more convenient and what is absolutely necessary. We'll just take the famous Incirlik example. I believe that if the military planners of the U.S. are doing what they typically do, they have already sketched out, I would imagine, alternatives. I mean, other options than Incirlik. These may just be suppositions, but I think it's a very good point that you make about what's the plan B? You know, the plan for the deterioration of relations if things don't go well from either side. In other words, we and the EU and NATO, even though we have many common concerns, we also are misaligned in some ways, and we never really get it together to be effective with Erdogan. That's one possibility. And the other one is we're effective with him, but he doesn't care. And he just ignores us. So if you could respond to that a little bit, I'd appreciate that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think you're absolutely right that Erdogan has this amazing chameleon-like power to be anything to anyone, and sort of to insinuate himself as sort of the necessary man of the moment. And we've certainly seen him do that across four now U.S. administrations, or at least three, and trying to do it with a fourth, right? It's amazing the sort of the shape-shifting nature here, where he presented himself as sort of the moderate Muslim Democrat to President Bush, who was he was the example and the test case of the freedom agenda and sort of the democracy works in the Middle East. He was sort of Obama's best friend, or one of his top five friends, but also sort of proved that the U.S. could reset relations and have good relations with Muslims, right? For President Trump, it's not really clear what the basis of that relationship was. But at least certainly part of it was the suggestion that, if the U.S. wants to take a step back from the region, then Turkey was ready to willing and step to step forward and right and sort of take some of that burden.
Right.
And all of these sort of suggestion and now with President Biden, is as best as I can tell, the suggestion is, don't look over here where we're buying the S-400. We can be your counter-Russia partner. When it comes to dealing with Moscow, because we know you really don't like the Russians,
Right.
and all of these with the past presidents, he sort of insinuated himself into foreign policy through his direct contact with successive presidents, most notably with President Trump. But even going further back than that, I mean, I remember being in Turkey in the summer of 2013, shortly after Gezi, and talking to Turkish officials. Who said, oh yes, Erdogan just got off the phone with Obama, and Obama was saying, listen, I have this Occupy Wall Street problem. Can you tell me how you dealt with Gezi so effectively and give me some tips? Like, I doubt that actually happened, but the fact that these phone calls were happening also allowed Erdogan to spin them and spin his own and raise his own stature in addition to influencing U.S. policy. So, I think the first recommendation that the report makes is that U.S. policy with Turkey really needs to be right-sized. That direct president-to-president relationship really needs to be taken down a notch, both to try to defeat the superpower that Erdogan has, but also to communicate that he is not, the best friend and most trusted advisor to American presidents, for other leaders and for Turkish citizens to understand that. But also, to start deflating this illusion that we need Turkey more than it needs us. And even as concerns about Turkey have grown, I think one of the striking things about U.S. policy is, we've never stopped in official communications and in our actions or talking about the historic and significant alliance with Turkey, and sort of treating it as if it was still a functioning partnership and alliance. And so we've never really communicated to the Turks that, maybe this isn't working, maybe we don't need you, as you said. And so I do think it's important to make that case. And I think we're more likely to make it if we can do it in concert with our partners, as opposed to allowing Erdogan to keep playing us off of each other.
Yeah, I would agree. I think what I would call the depersonalization of diplomatic relations. It's always, from my almost 3 decades in the State Department, it's always a problem that the president, and sometimes the Secretary of State, but usually it's the president, has decided that if he can just get that great relationship going with the leader of another country. We saw this, with George W. Bush, most interestingly with Tony Blair. Now, there were all sorts of reasons why building that relationship was really important. I can't figure out what was the importance of Barack Obama building a close personal relationship with President Erdogan, and certainly President Trump and President Erdogan, okay, maybe birds of a feather flock together. But other than that, I think what was going on there, though, was using the facade of a personal relationship when actually both of them were engaged in a very transactional relationship. I mean, you know, President Trump, I think, was trying to use President Erdogan, as you said, so that he could get U.S. troops out of the Middle East, which was, you know, one of the first things that he was set upon doing. And then President Erdogan realized that he really had lost all of his friends in Congress. And anything that he was going to do, he needed some friend, maybe in quotation marks, to defend him against Capitol Hill. And it worked. How long did it take President Trump to finally impose CATSA sanctions for the S-400s on Turkey? It took, 3 years and several months, right? but I think you're absolutely right in saying that we have to take the personalities out of the relationship between the United States and Turkey. We have to turn it into the relationship between two nation states that, of course, are going to pursue their own national interest, but where they can see where their national interests align, and so that they can have positive relations, but also they can have mutually beneficial interactions in the region. We'll see.
Yeah. Right. And the reason that we have diplomats like yourself is precisely to negotiate those relationships and try to make them work. And if we're not using our diplomatic channels, in fact, if we're allowing Turkey to abuse those diplomatic channels when they send, you know, our employees, foreign national employees, at least of our embassy and consulate to jail, then we can't really expect to have a functioning relationship there.
Yeah.
So I do also think, I think it is important to note that despite the overall chumminess of the Trump-Erdogan relationship, the only time in recent history that we've seen Erdogan really reverse course on U.S. relations with the release of Pastor Andrew Brunson was after Trump, hit him pretty hard with tariffs and with sanctions. It's really the only time the U.S. has strayed from the everything is okay, we're still partners rhetoric, then potentially again the letter in October 2019 sort of backpedaling the green light of Turkey's invasion of northeast Syria, and whatever role that might have played in setting up the final ceasefire there.
Yeah.
But there was a little bit of a hard edge to that relationship.
Yeah, I mean we could talk about the whole. You see, that's why I think I really do think that the image of a friendship, of a personal relationship, was for both men just a facade. They put that in front. But in fact, they were really interested in what they could, through the use of that image, what they could obtain in reality. So when, I would note, and actually I wrote about this a couple of times, for Aval, I would note that Pastor Brunson, a U.S. citizen and a member of the same evangelical Presbyterian denomination as Mike Pompeo, did not fall into the same category as Sherkan Gökçe, the NASA scientist, dual national. And there are, in fact, diplomatic and consular rules that apply differently to a dual national, but I don't think Donald Trump was aware of those. I think what he was aware of was that Brunson was, in his mind, a 100% American citizen, whereas Sherkan was a semi-American. I mean, that sounds a little cynical, but it's not how I'm thinking. It's my perception of how Donald Trump would be thinking. And the way he responded to three different Turkish nationals who worked for the American embassy being thrown into jail on spurious charges, I think also revealed something about Mr. Trump. But I think you're absolutely right. He really came down very hard on Mr. Erdogan about Pastor Brunson, and he was willing to use tariffs and to sanctions against ministers of the government because that fit so much into President Trump's notion that his job was to protect American citizens. Now, of course, he made these separations between 100% and kind of dual nationals, but that's another story. But we're actually kind of like running out of time, which is a real shame because we've only scratched the surface. So we're going to have to cut off, but I do want to say this, we have only scratched the surface. And anybody who's listening to this, I really do encourage you to go to the website and get the report that Blaise Michetal has written. And correct me if I get this wrong, but the website is just jinsa.org.
That's right, jinsa.org.
Okay, so Blaise, we're going to have you back. We did just scratch the surface. Maybe we've went.
Well, that's the great thing about Turkey. It's the gift that keeps on giving.
Yes, there's going to be.
We all owe President Erdogan a debt of gratitude for keeping us. So fascinated, if not employed.
Well, we who worked at the embassy talk about the fact that there was no vaccine for infection by Turkey. Yeah. In other words, there's something that happens if you really get into Turkish life and culture, and it's not just the politics, which is incredibly interesting. And the more you get into it, the more interesting it becomes. It really just draws you in. I'm also of the opinion that Istanbul is one of the three greatest cities in the world. But, so there is that too. The food is also wonderful. But so I definitely want to have you back and we can pursue more about the solution. Or the direction of U.S. strategy for a lonely Turkey. And with that, I'm going to sign off and again, remind people, go to jinsa.org, jinsa.org, and read the report. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
You can follow Ahval News Online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. All you need to know about Turkey is here for your ears, mind, and attention. Thank you for listening to our podcast.